Up next, we have our book reading program, Ohomoni Iyotaka, read by Gail Hubling.
The Lakota Way, Stories and Lessons for Living by Joseph M. Marshall III. Chapter 5, Love, Chantoknake, to place and hold in one's heart. The story of the cottonwoods. Cottonwood trees can be found along the rivers and creeks in Lakota country. They are tall and strong and live long lives. In midsummer, the breezes play with their leaves, rustling and rattling them until they sing soft, joyful songs that everyone, four-leggeds, wingeds, crawlers, and two-leggeds like to hear. Songs that can soothe a troubled mind, soften even the hardest heart, or heal a broken one. This is the story of two cottonwood trees who began their lives as something else. Many, many winters before the white man's steamboat brought the running face sickness, smallpox, up the great muddy river and killed off almost 2,000 Lakota in the year 1837. Two young people met at a summer gathering. She had just gone through her woman's ceremony, and he had counted his first victory against an enemy. She had beautiful dark eyes, and he was straight and tall. They couldn't keep their eyes off one another. Many evenings he stood with her in the soft folds of an elk-hide courting robe just outside her family's lodge, as her mother kept a watchful eye. Hidden beneath the robe, the young couple exchanged soft kisses and whispered promises. And at the dances, when the rabbit and round dance songs were sung, she would pull him into the dancing circle. They would dance side by side, moving together step for step, as if they were one person, their gentle voices blending in song with the softly pounding drums. Everyone could see that the hearts of these two young people were only for each other, and the old people marveled at how their voices together seemed to rise as one. It was only a matter of time, everyone was certain, before White Lance would take a gift of horses to the family of Red Willow Woman to ask for her hand in marriage. The summer gathering ended, and the two young people reluctantly parted. White Lance rode away with a promise that he would gather many horses. Summer passed and autumn came. Red Willow Woman's village was encamped near Turtle Butte, while White Lance's people were many days' ride to the south near the White Earth River. He had ridden with several war parties against the Arikara and the Crow and distinguished himself by fighting bravely. On one raid, he single-handedly captured 12 horses that, of course, were part of the bride price for Red Willow Woman's family. Leaves turned color and were falling when her village moved just north of the Sandhill country to hunt buffalo. It was there that White Lance found them. He and two friends drove 18 horses into the encampment. But his soaring heart fell to earth like a wounded duck, his dreams crushed by Red Willow Woman's own words. With tears flowing, she told him she had been promised to a young man named He Crow. He was from a respected family, and she was honor-bound to do her father's bidding. White Lance had never known such a feeling. The pain in his heart took his breath away. He could not think clearly, and his very spirit seemed to curl up inside him like a lost child. Out of shame and confusion, he sent his friends away and rode aimlessly for several days and nights before he returned north. Back in his own village, he hid in his mother's lodge and would not eat for days. In the spring came word that He Crow and Red Willow Woman had been wed. When he heard that, White Lance took his pain and frustration on the warpath against the Crow. On the battlefield, he acted recklessly, not seeming to care whether he lived or died. He Crow, meanwhile, learned that while Red Willow Woman was everything a wife should be, and their lodge was always neat and orderly, her heart and mind seemed to be elsewhere. The following spring, a daughter was born, but that only seemed to divert Red Willow Woman's attention even more. To cover his disappointment, He Crow rode out often to hunt and accepted every invitation to take to the warpath. Time passed. Many winters came and went. White Lance and Red Willow Woman saw each other once every four seasons at the summer gatherings. Both of them knew that everyone was watching and acted with the utmost propriety. Though it was plain to anyone who knew of their situation before that nothing, not even time, could weaken what they truly felt in their hearts. In time, White Lance took a wife, good medicine, the widow of a friend killed during a buffalo hunt. He became father to her son, but she understood that while he was a good provider and a dutiful husband, his heart would always belong to another. More winters passed, and White Lance won many war bonnets, and many men rode with him when he led. He was sought after as a man who gave wise counsel, and he became a leader in peace as well as war. But many, including good medicine, saw that he was alone often. In those moments he was seen to be staring off, as if into another time or another place. Like every good Lakota mother, Red Willow Woman was devoted to her children, for now she had a son as well. But she, too, whiled away many quiet moments, staring off to the north, especially during summer evenings. White Lance and Red Willow Woman seemed to live for the summer gatherings, when they would have a chance to talk for a few moments. Each asked politely after the other's welfare and how it was with their families, but in their eyes a light would shine and they both seemed to come alive. Neither White Lance nor Red Willow Woman dishonored their marriages or acted contrary to what was expected of them. The price of honor was to give up true happiness, and each had paid the price with heartbreak. But He Crow and Good Medicine had paid a price as well. It had not been easy for either of them. During one summer gathering, He Crow sent word to Good Medicine. They met secretly and talked. That autumn, long after the summer gathering ended, and when the villages had finished their buffalo hunts to make meat for the winter, Good Medicine asked White Lance to take her to visit her relatives who were in camp to the south. Likewise, He Crow announced his plans to visit relatives to the north and invited Red Willow Woman to accompany him. The morning after the first night of the new moon, both couples left their villages. They traveled alone because all their children were now grown. After several days, White Lance and Good Medicine arrived at a certain place near the Smoking Earth River, a place where hunters often camped along Horse Creek. Good Medicine said she wanted to camp there for a few days. He Crow and Red Willow Woman arrived a day later. It was awkward, but the couples were happy to see one another. Near the end of that first evening, as cool breezes crawled along from the northwest, warning of a hard winter coming, He Crow did a strange thing. As they all sat in the light of a crackling fire, he tossed a stick to the ground and spoke to Red Willow Woman. "That stick is you," he said. "I cast you away. You know that in our ways a Lakota husband can cast away his wife by doing so. I have my reasons for this, and now you are away from me. You are free. You are free to go where you choose." Red Willow Woman was stunned. Before she could speak, Good Medicine also did a strange thing. She brought White Lance's belonging out of her lodge and placed them on the ground near the door. "I give you your things," she said to White Lance. "There is no longer a place for them in my lodge. You know this to be a Lakota woman's right, to cast out her husband in this manner. I have my reasons. You are free to go where you choose." White Lance was stunned. After a moment, he and Red Willow Woman understood what was happening. "You are the man in her heart," said He Crow to White Lance. "You should be the man in her life, and you shall be." "And you are the woman in his heart," Good Medicine said to Red Willow Woman. "Take your rightful place with him as you should have been allowed to do so long ago. You have both done your duty. Now you must follow your hearts." The next morning, Good Medicine took down her lodge, and He Crow promised to see her safely to her relatives. That night, White Lance and Red Willow Woman came together as man and wife 25 winters after they had first met. They lingered in the valley of the Smoking Earth River for days, walking along the river even as the last leaves of autumn floated to the earth. The world seemed new to them. The sky never looked so blue, and the call of the high-flying geese no longer sounded like a sad song. Like the sun chasing away shadows, every new moment together chased off the memories of what should have been. Their hearts soared like hawks on the winds. The first cold gusts of winter chased them to the sheltering gullies of the Great Muddy River. There they pitched their lodge, and White Lance hunted so they could take meat for their journey to Swift Bear's village, many long days to the northwest. One afternoon, he returned from the hunt to find the lodge empty, the ashes in the fire pit cold. Red Willow Woman was nowhere to be seen, and her horse was gone too. With a little daylight left for tracking, a worried White Lance grabbed his weapons and set out. It was not long before he found her footprints over a set of hoof prints. From the tracks, it was plain that Red Willow Woman was trailing her horse. Snow began to fall lightly at first, as he followed their tracks. As the afternoon wore on, the snow became thicker and thicker. Soon White Lance could no longer see any tracks. He began to call out her name, shouting over and over again. Daylight was fading. He knew it was nearly sundown. The snow covered the ground and hid the sky. There was nothing but whiteness. Then he heard a faint cry, a voice carried by the wind. White Lance ran toward the sound, and soon dark shapes appeared out of the whiteness, and his heart pounded like a fast drum. One of them was Red Willow Woman, huddled on the ground, the snow beneath her red with blood. Over her stood an angry and powerful bear with blood on his claws, roaring as it turned to face White Lance. As a cry of anguish and rage, like an angry summer thunderclap, rose from his chest, White Lance ran and thrust his lance. It went true and pierced the animal's great chest, but the beast was powerful and he fought back. Its sharp claws slashed and slashed until White Lance was covered in his own blood. But he stabbed with the lance again and again, piercing the bear's chest each time. The snow turned red with their blood, and the cold air was filled with their bellows of rage and pain. They fell almost at the same heartbeat, the great bear finally weakened by a final thrust of the lance deep into his heart, but he had ripped open the throat of his killer. With the last remaining heartbeats of life, White Lance crawled to Red Willow Woman and took her in his arms. She summoned her waning strength to pull him close, and so they walked into eternity together as husband and wife. 2 summers were to pass before a group of hunters found the bones near the shore of the Great Muddy River. 2 skeletons were entangled. Nearby lay the bleached bones of a bear, the point of a lance embedded inside its ribs. It was not difficult for the hunters to imagine what had happened. They also saw 2 cottonwood saplings growing side by side in a grassy slope near the water, as if growing from the same root. Their families placed the bones of White Lance and Red Willow Woman on the same scaffold. As the years passed, the saplings grew into tall, sturdy trees, their upper branches twisting around each other like hands interlocking fingers. As more seasons and years passed, people would come to sit under the 2 cottonwoods, and in their cool shade, they told the story of 2 young people, she with dark, beautiful eyes, and he who stood straight and tall. And as the story was told, the breezes rustled the leaves of the 2 cottonwoods until they sounded like 2 gentle voices blending in song, 2 voices that rose as one. Several years ago, I went to the Great Muddy River, now called the Missouri. I went there alone. I had lost someone dear to me, a friend whose own life was only just beginning when it was taken from her. I walked those shores and watched the rolling waters and recalled the story of the woman with the dark, beautiful eyes and her warrior who stood straight and tall. In a grove of young cottonwoods, I rested in the shade. There was no way to know if I was near the spot where the 2 cottonwoods had stood, but I had heard that long ago, after the 2 trees had fallen and were taken back into the earth, their stumps could be seen. I found no stumps, but I could hear all around me the rustling leaves of the young cottonwoods, coaxed by gentle breezes, and I thought I could hear voices singing. Perhaps it was only my broken heart yearning for comfort, but it was easy to imagine that these young cottonwoods were the children of those 2 who stood so long ago. My heart wanted to believe it because there was something soothing, something full of promise in the songs of those young cottonwoods. The Story of the Flute Maker. Beneath the low branches of an old cedar, he awoke to a cool breeze caressing his face. For a moment, Cloud wondered where he was and why. Then he remembered what had brought him to this grassy bed beneath the cedar, and the pain of remembering took his breath away. "My father has accepted the gifts brought by Hollowhorn," Dawn Woman had told Cloud after he had waited for an entire evening by the trail to the river. Hollowhorn is a fine man and a good provider. He will take good care of me. But you are always in my thoughts. You have been in my heart since we were small children. Have you forgotten the promises we made to each other? He had pleaded. We were only children, she had replied. And what is the promise of a boy against the harshness of life? My promise is everything I have, he had said. There was a time it made your heart fly, and you cannot tell me that the thought of me will not do so again and again. Cloud had watched as Dawn Woman walked away into the twilight, soon to be the wife of Hollowhorn. Driven by a cold, sickening pain that shriveled his very being, he crossed the river and ran across the prairies. Trying to outrun the pain in his heart, he ran until his legs drained of all their strength and all he could do was roll beneath a tree. Only with sleep did the pain subside, but now it returned like a raging flood. There was nothing he could do but curl up in a ball. He lay like a stone as the morning wore on. A blackbird alighted in the branches above him. Ants crawled over him, but he paid no heed, his eyes open but unseeing. When the sun was near to the middle of the sky, the wind sprang up. Only when he heard a faint, mournful voice did he begin to stir, and then only because the voice echoed what he felt in his broken heart. The voice grew louder as the wind blew harder, and it faded when the wind abated. Cloud thought it was his own voice crying out the pain in his heart because it was such a hollow, haunted tone rising and floating aimlessly. Not knowing why, he decided to find out who or what the voice belonged to. Scrambling from beneath the cedar branch, he stumbled through the grove of trees along a creek. Something drew him to a particular old, wind-bent cedar as the plaintive voice grew louder. There, halfway up, was a dead branch smaller than his wrist, a hollow branch with holes, perhaps drilled by woodpeckers, and with each gust of wind, the branch seemed to cry. Cloud had found the voice. He sat and listened, held fast by the mournful tones that rose and fell with the whim of the wind. At sundown, the wind weakened, and so did the voice. Cloud climbed the old cedar and inspected the hollow branch. It was long dead, he could tell, killed by the worms that the woodpeckers were drilling for. In doing so, they had opened holes through which the wind flowed and unlocked the strange, mournful voice. Cloud broke off the branch and climbed down. He sat on the creek bank and blew through the hollow opening, but the voice didn't cry. He noticed that it was like the eagle bone whistle his father had given him and thought it might function much the same. Placing a small piece of wood over the top hole, he was able to coax sound from the hollow branch. At first, it was simply noise, but eventually he began to make it sing somewhat like the wind had. As the sun went down, Cloud paused long enough to gather dry wood and build a fire. He had no food, and his only means of protection was a stone knife in his belt. It did not matter, for his heart was broken. If the great silver-tipped bear came in the night, or some enemy was even now stalking him, he was already dead inside. Dawn Woman was to be the wife of Hollowhorn and bear his children. Life had no meaning. He kept the fire going far into the night as he sat and blew on the hollow branch. He found that placing his fingertips over the five holes would lower or raise the pitch. Moreover, when he coaxed the voice from the branch, it strangely eased the pain in his heart. So, of course, he blew and made the branch sing until once again he dropped over from exhaustion. Morning found him curled next to the cold gray ashes of his fire pit, his arms around the hollow branch. He awoke lost, unkempt, and hungry, his heart still torn. Stumbling to the creek, he washed his face and took a long drink, and in the water he saw a lonely young man. He stayed in the grove all day, blowing on the hollow branch. By sundown, he could make the branch sing better than the wind had. Through it came the voice of his grief-stricken heart, rising and falling with high and plaintive notes. Cloud decided that the voice of the branch sounded much like the great cranes that flew overhead each spring and fall. With his knife, he carved the end of the branch into the shape of a crane's head and bill. As he made the branch sing, the land and everything on it fell silent, listening to the voice of a broken heart. Another night came, another lonely fire. Another dawn found him next to cold ashes with his pain. Hunger he could push aside, but the only medicine for the pain in his heart was the singing hollow branch. Because he and the wind had given the branch a voice, he decided to call it Hokarapi, to make a voice. It was, of course, a flute. Another day passed. Cloud blew on his flute and let it cry for him, giving voice to the bottomless pain in his heart. Now and then he paused to work on the flute, reshaping the mouthpiece or making all the finger holes the same size. He had not eaten for 3 days. Weak and delirious, he thought he saw Dawn Woman standing by the side of his fire. When he reached out for her, she ran away, or so he thought. So he followed. After a time, he simply wandered across the prairie, playing the flute, not caring where he was going. Cloud awoke from a delirious sleep to find himself next to a river. Washing his face and taking a drink, he staggered to the shade of a tree and began blowing on his flute to chase away the pain in his heart. The notes flowed from his flute, rising, falling, and sobbing, crying out the anguish from deep inside. Suddenly, Cloud heard voices and opened his eyes to realize that he was on the riverbank opposite his own village. In his delirium, he had found his way home. All the women in the village, young and old, were standing on the other bank staring at him and listening to him play his flute. Among them was Dawn Woman. The pain of losing her engulfed him like a flash flood. All he could do was blow on the flute and let it cry his anguish. The lilting voice of the flute rose and fell, sighing and sobbing in soft, heartbreaking notes. Cloud noticed that the women were as drawn to the voice of the hollow branch as he had been when he first heard it. There was not a single man in the crowd, only women, old women, young women, and girls, all entranced by the crying flute, including Dawn Woman. Certain that by now she was the wife of Hollowhorn, Cloud's grief poured out through his flute. Soon Dawn Woman crossed the river and stood before him, her eyes down but casting frequent bold glances as the flute sang. "There was a time when a young man I knew made my heart fly," she said softly. Cloud stopped playing. "Now he sings a strange song that makes my heart sad. What are you doing to me?" "I am giving my pain a voice," he replied, "because the young woman in my heart has become the wife of another. The spirits have given me this Hokarapi. So to do so, I can no longer make her heart fly." "Can your Hokarapi sing out in joy?" Dawn Woman asked. "I can give it no joy, for I do not feel it. And it is I who give this thing its voice. But I feel joy at your return," she said. "After you left, I knew that life's path without you would be lonely. For you see, you are in my heart, and always will be. I have taken no husband, unless it would be you." Cloud could not believe his ears, but he saw the truth in Dawn Woman's eyes. His heart flew, and he began playing his flute. This time the flute's song was that of promise, of hope, and joy, rising and falling like the wind dancing on the prairies, a song of life. Once again, all the women were enthralled, drawn to the voice of the flute. The years went by, and to the union of Cloud and Dawn Woman were born 2 sons. As they grew, Cloud taught them to play the flute, and he became known far and wide as the flute maker. Young men and boys came to Cloud and asked to learn, and so he taught them all to make and play the flute. And he told them how the spirits had guided him to find the Hokarapi, taking him from the despair of a broken heart to the joy of a dream fulfilled. "That is why," he would tell them, "there will always be a hollow tone of sadness in the voice of each flute, to remind everyone that while the flute is played to win love, winning love is also winning the chance of a broken heart, such as love." Thereafter, on summer evenings when the fireflies twinkled in the dusk, flutes could be heard singing sweetly, provocatively, up and down the river valleys, their voices touching the heart of any woman, young or old. Hokarapi, the flute, born of despair, became the voice of courtship, of promise, of hope, and of love. Man and Woman, Bow and Arrow. I was privileged to witness 2 eagles performing their courtship and mating ritual. They began their dance high above the earth, where they soared and came together in an embrace that locked onto the other. Holding fast to each other, they plummeted toward the land. When I thought they would surely crash into the ground, they let go of one another, gained flight and altitude, and then did it all over again. In utter awe and fascination, I watched this breathtaking aerial display, realizing suddenly that I was watching life keeping itself in balance while the eagles were fulfilling their purpose and honoring their destiny. The world works best in balance. To every action, there is an opposite and equal reaction. So the scientists say, a dry, unemotional premise that suggests a dynamic truth. Up and down, back and forth, night and day, cold and hot, male and female, man and woman. In balance and symmetry is beauty and strength. There are many ways to describe it, to give it an image, but I prefer most the story of the bow and arrow, which was often at the heart of marriage ceremonies in the old days. A very old man performed the ceremony in those days, and he talked to all the people who gathered. In his hands he would hold a bow and an arrow. He explained that a bow without the arrow is of no use, likewise for the arrow. If a bow is seen alone, one wonders where the arrow is. The same is true of the arrow because one without the other is not balanced. But the relationship of the bow and arrow is more than togetherness. In order for them to be effective, the arrow must fly true. To do that, it must be perfectly straight. Yet no matter how straight the arrow can fly, it cannot reach the target unless the bow is strong. One cannot fulfill its purpose without the other. My grandparents' marriage had been more or less arranged by my grandmother's mother. After her mother's death, my grandmother would inherit a substantial amount of land, and her mother wanted someone to help safeguard her property. My great-grandmother Molly had always thought highly of my grandfather as a young man. She spoke with his mother, my great-grandmother Elizabeth, and the arrangements were made. My grandfather was a quiet, hard-working man, a very humble man, and always treated everyone with the utmost respect. I suspect those are the qualities that his future mother-in-law liked. My grandparents were married in 1920, and their marriage lasted until my grandfather died in 1975. My maternal grandparents raised me. In effect, I was their third child. If they ever raised their voices at each other, they didn't do it in my presence. They taught me about life, not so much by telling me how to live it, but by showing me. I can think of no other couple, except for my paternal grandparents, who treated each other with more respect, respect firmly rooted in unconditional love. I can never think of one without thinking of the other. I couldn't then, and I can't now. And when they described the relationship of the bow and arrow, they were talking about themselves. If there was any weakness that either of them demonstrated, it was the occasional lost look I saw across my grandmother's face in the years after my grandfather died. I didn't realize how much she missed him until 2 days before she died. Standing near the foot of her bed in the hospital, I waited for a nurse to leave. A moment or two after the nurse left, my grandmother turned her head to the left and spoke. "Do you remember that log house by the river?" she asked quietly, even though there was a tube down her throat. I was about to answer that I didn't remember such a house when I realized she wasn't looking at me. She was looking at a particular spot just to the left of the foot of the bed. There was no one there, at least no one I could see. But no one could tell me that my grandfather wasn't there. No one can convince me that he didn't come for her. No one can tell me he wasn't in the room waiting for her when she died early in the morning 2 days later. We laid my grandmother to rest next to my grandfather. As my brothers and I and our male cousins were filling in the grave, I was suddenly compelled to look skyward. There, high above the cemetery, two hawks were soaring together on the wind. My maternal grandparents' wonderful relationship lasted a lifetime. My paternal grandparents were married 55 years before my grandfather Marshall died in 1974. Both couples made a commitment that never wavered, and I know without a doubt that they honestly loved one another. Their commitment went beyond this life, as was the case with a neighbor of mine. Nearly 20 years ago, in a small town on the Rosebud Reservation, she was a middle-aged widow who had lost her husband to a heart attack. Each summer, on the anniversary of his death, she would rise before dawn and stand on the east side of her house, and as the sun rose, she would sing an honoring song for her husband. And throughout the day, she would take food to all her neighbors in his memory. She never remarried. Would that we could all win such love and commitment. The words to an old Lakota Kahomani, a round dance song, express hope and the promise of finding and having love, perhaps of being in balance. My relatives tell me you are asking about me. We will be together soon. Like so many other aspects of our existence, our values, traditions, and customs, love is all about balance. It is the way of the world that in every species there are two life forces, male and female. To deny this reality or walk outside of it would be to create imbalance. To bring a life into this world that is consequence of lust rather than an offspring of the bond of love between a man and a woman is to give that life a burden that is certainly imbalance. Undeniably, imbalance does occur when someone walks a path outside the natural order. Even among us, as with every other people the world over, there is homosexuality. But rather than ostracize anyone who treads that path and thereby create further imbalance, we choose tolerance, which often promotes understanding over strife. Among us Lakota, as with many other indigenous cultures, we include a place for homosexuals by not denying them the opportunity to be full-fledged members of the community. As such, they are part of and not apart from. Hence, balance is maintained. The love and hope expressed in the old song is more than the desire for two people to be together. It also carries with it the hope for balance and harmony. In a perfect world, two people who truly love one another and are meant for each other are always brought together. But in the real world, we know it doesn't always happen, or that it happens in ways we don't always understand. In The Story of the Cottonwoods, the husband and wife who eventually stepped aside unselfishly to allow true love to run its course knew that their sacrifice was the right thing to do, no matter how painful it might have been. The union of White Lance and Willow Woman was the world strengthening itself by taking one more step towards balance and harmony. And when they lost their lives prematurely, life itself found a way to reward them for their love and devotion and keeping itself in balance. The young man in the story of the flute maker was understandably devastated when the love of his life spurned him. His pain and anguish gave birth to the flute, and it became the voice of his heartbreak. And when he played, the whole world paused to listen because the young man's loss was not his alone. Cloud without dawn woman was an imbalance like sunrise without sunset. Dark without light, up without down, the bow without the arrow. But when dawn woman realized the only course was to follow her heart, balance was restored, and thus the flute became an instrument of hope. Each time a flute sings, though it sings of hope and promise of happiness, there will always be a tone of sadness to remind us there are two sides to everything, and the world works best on balance. As an avid archer, I shoot my bows and arrows frequently. My grandfather taught me to handcraft primitive Lakota bows and arrows. A well-made bow and arrow have an aesthetic beauty all their own. There is nothing quite like feeling the power of the bow when it is drawn, unless it is the exhilaration of watching the arrow fly towards its target. This simple activity demonstrates a profound truth. It matters not whether one is the bow or the arrow. What matters is the mutual purpose they fulfill, the balance they achieve. And that concludes Chapter 5.
This program is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to Ohomani Iotaka on KDKO 89.5 FM.